Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, we'll be looking at the United Nations as it begins its working session with highlights from Pope Benedict's 2008 speech to the General Assembly in New York. And remembering Vietnamese Cardinal Van Thuan. The United Nations resumes work Tuesday after the summer break. For the occasion, we go back to Pope Benedict's visit to the UN in April 2008. His speech to the UN General Assembly that month touched on issues of peace, international security, sustainable development in Africa, and international human rights. Emma McCarthy remembers some of the highlights of the Pope's speech, and then we take a look at the Holy See's representation at the Global Forum.
During his address, Pope Benedict highlighted the 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. He said human rights guarantee the safeguarding of human dignity.
Indeed, the victims of hardship and despair, whose human dignity is violated with impunity, become easy prey to the call to violence, and they can then become violators of peace. The common good that human rights help to accomplish cannot, however, be attained merely by applying correct procedures, nor even less by achieving a balance between competing rights. The merit of the Universal Declaration is that it has enabled different cultures, juridical expressions, and institutional models to converge around a fundamental nucleus of values and hence of rights.
Pope Benedict also addressed religious freedom, which he said cannot just be confined to the practice of the faith.
The full guarantee of religious liberty cannot be limited to the free exercise of worship, but has to give due consideration to the public dimension of religion, and hence to the possibility of believers playing their part in building the social order.
Pope Benedict concluded that it should never be necessary to deny God in order to enjoy one's rights. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Well, you'd be forgiven if you didn't know that the Vatican is also represented at the United Nations in New York. I didn't know until I came to work for Vatican Radio. Neither did Monsignor James Reinert, who only found out when he was called to work in the Holy See's office there back in the late 1990s. Now an officer at the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Monsignor Reinert told me about what the Vatican's office at the UN does, and above all, why the Holy See has chosen to hold permanent observer status rather than full membership in the UN.
We're an observer country in the United Nations, an observer state, that the Holy See has chosen that this is the status that it wants to maintain. There would be nothing that would keep it from becoming a member should the Holy See, should the Holy Father decide to become full members of the United Nations. Observer status allows the Holy See to participate in meetings. It allows them to join in the debate, join in negotiations for different documents, resolutions coming out, but it then keeps us from voting, the ability to block a movement within the UN. We can't object to a resolution being forwarded because of that status. And from what I understand from my own experience, that we have chosen, the Holy See has chosen to be an observer, because then we don't get involved with some things that we can't as Holy See become involved with. If there would be a vote on going to war, a vote on sanctions, these kind of things that would be expected of a member, the Holy See would then choose not to be part of that. And so we keep the observer status.
Yet, when talking of a war, especially a war that the Holy See does not think is justified, you'd think that the Holy See would want to pose an objection or vote against a measure for a war.
Certainly, but there would be also times when we join in the discussion, but if it comes down to being as a member, then becoming a member of the Security Council, for instance, there would be times when a vote would be expected and a vote would have to be taken on certain issues that the Holy See wouldn't involve itself with.
What other countries are simply observers at the UN?
Palestine has observer status, and that's all. In the past, I think it was about 2002, up until that time, Switzerland was an observer also. And the Swiss government decided to take on full membership, and so they are a member state. So it's right now the Holy See, which is a permanent observer state, and Palestine, which is a permanent observer. There's a slight difference in the nuance there.
Of course, also, Palestine is not an internationally recognized state as such.
As such.
Though not everyone will agree with what the Pope has to say in today's world, he's nevertheless considered one of the world's most powerful moral voices. Could you say, in a sense, that the Pope's office to the UN, the Holy See's office, gives voice to this moral conscience on a global level? And what sort of issues did you typically deal with when you were at the New York headquarters?
Well, it's important, and you mentioned the New York headquarters, to also realize that we're present in the UN offices in Paris, at UNESCO, in Vienna, in Geneva, and Nairobi at the environmental offices. So it's not just New York. And yes, the voice of the Holy See is seen as a moral voice for these issues. We don't get into the political debate, but we ring the bell when we see something that this isn't right, ethically, morally. Maybe something needs to be changed, something needs to be discussed or debated. And we always have seen that as the most important role of the Holy See within the United Nations system.
Can you give me some examples of maybe some issues that you worked on when you were there in New York? And did people take the Holy See's comments or observations seriously?
We always had a voice, and it was heard. Maybe it wasn't listened to all of the time, but it was heard. One of the things, it didn't happen in my time, it happened just before I arrived in 1995, but the Cairo conference. And had it not been for the work of the Holy See.
On population.
Population and development. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for the Holy See and the allies that it brought to the fight, the Latin American countries, many of the Muslim countries, abortion would probably have been declared a human right at that conference. And people recognized then, and continue to recognize it, it was the role of the Holy See that thwarted that and many other issues related to contraception and reproductive health and abortion. Other than that, sanctions, economic sanctions, we've always been a voice against unilateral sanctions, sanctions that harm the common people, the people on the ground. Many other issues. We were involved with all of the issues that were discussed, some not as much as others, but certainly on the social and economic spheres, in disarmament, in peace building, those sort of issues, that we were very much involved in and continue to be involved in those things.
I know one of the things that you worked on in the past was maritime treaties and seabed treaties.
That the question would be asked, what are you doing here at these meetings? What interest does the Holy See have? But that was always a good example of letting people know that, yes, we didn't have a political or economic interest in this, but we saw our role as making sure that things were done fairly for the developing countries, for countries that might not also have had a direct interest in this, but wanted to be at the table. And so the Holy See was able to give voice to a number of people, organizations, countries that may not have had a voice in those things.
Of course, those issues are quite important because many countries today are interested in deep sea excavation for oil and other minerals. People stand to gain economically from this, don't they?
The Holy See was involved with that because we saw the seabed as the common heritage of everyone. If I lived in a landlocked country, I really wouldn't have an interest in what was going on in the open ocean. And so the Seabed Authority was created. And that's just one example of many organizations that came out of the UN to make sure that when that seabed was being exploited, mining or oil or whatever it might be, that all countries would share in the benefits of it, not just the ones who are actually doing the drilling or the mining, that all countries would share in the profits that were coming from what was considered all of our heritage.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned sanctions a minute ago. Did you deal with issues such as ongoing sanctions against Cuba? But what countries come to mind, and what are the reasons really behind the Holy See's position against sanctions and embargoes?
Well, we're not opposed to sanctions and embargoes. I'm sure that we would have been in favor is the wrong word, but the sanctions that brought down the apartheid regime in South Africa would have been seen as a beneficial thing. And there are big sanctions and little sanctions. And they would be discussed in two places in the UN, once in the second committee, the Economic Committee of the General Assembly, and also in the Security Council. Now, I myself was never involved with a meeting in the Security Council, but I would participate in the discussions in the second committee, and we would usually make a statement, the Holy See would make a statement against unilateral sanctions that were harmful to an economy beyond forcing a government to change. And yes, Cuba would come up, Iran, Libya. There are a number of countries that have various sanctions imposed upon them. If the UN was going to do it, we would be supportive to the point of, if it's going to make a real change, if there's going to be a time limit on this, if it's going to be lifted, if there's a chance that something will come from this, the Holy See would support that. But it's those that become harmful to the population with no time limit, that are just ongoing, those we would have opposed.
And as observers, are you given the same opportunities as members to state your position?
They have speakers lists. You get yourself on the list and you make your statement when it comes your turn. That was one of the things that I was involved with, was formulating which topics we would make a formal statement on, and then arranging for the time and the date for those statements to be made. Mm.
What was your specialty exactly there in that office?
Whatever they told me to do. My background is in education. I covered mostly economic issues, second committee, but I was also involved with many of the social development issues, children, education, health, women, trade, those sorts of things. The environment came under the second committee, economic development issues, sustainable development issues. That's 90% of what I did following those concerns.
Did you have a favorite part of your job that you really liked? Or maybe somewhere that you felt you really made an impact?
In the discussions, in a meeting like the Commission on Social Development, where they would find a particular topic, and that would be the discussion this session, this year. And if it was something that I not only was interested in, but there was a real concern for the church, education, healthcare. One year we discussed how to deal with families and children in emergency situations. And I remember particularly that series of meetings, really coming away from it, I felt that we really had, the Holy See had made a difference in those discussions.
Why?
I don't know. Whether all of the stars were in alignment that day or those days, it just, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, and they were grueling meetings, I really felt satisfied coming out of that meeting that we had done something significant. The very last meeting that I attended before I came to Rome was a meeting on women and literacy. And I sat at the table with other delegates and formulated and had it included in the text, a literacy paragraph to make sure that all women and girls and then families wouldn't be excluded from these programs that they were developing. The paragraph was on literacy. The resolution itself was on development, social development, economic development, sustainable development, especially directed toward women. And we made sure that there was education and literacy provisions put in that. And again, it was one of those times when you walk out of there and you really feel we accomplished something today. Probably the highlight, if I can say, that there was one time in my experience at the UN, it was at the Johannesburg Summit on Sustainable Development in 2002. We had been supporting a number of issues in support of the developing countries. G77 is an organization within the member states of developing countries. It started out of the governments of 77 countries and China. Now it's 140 countries, the developing world. And our support had been recognized. They knew that we were a voice for them in the discussions. And on the last night, we had been discussing this document, this plan of action for many months, but it came down to the last night. And a compromise had been made. Language had been formulated on the last paragraphs. We finally had an agreement. We could bring this document forward. And the chairman of the Group of 77, came to us, came to the Holy See, came to me. I was sitting in the chair that day and said, "We won't move on this unless we have the Holy See's approval." And just, I was overwhelmed. But they saw that we had been so much involved in this that they wanted to make sure that if it was okay with us, if we were okay with the language, then it was finished, we'd move forward. And what a feeling that was, to have the whole world watching me talk to this gentleman and with fingers crossed saying, "Come on, Holy See, accept this. Let's get out of here." And we did, and it's finished.
Now, the Holy See is fortunate to be able to rely on the expertise of a wide range of experts in all sorts of fields, lawyers, experts in water rights, all kinds of things. They're dedicating their time basically free of charge to the Holy See on many of these issues. Who are some of these people, and what sort of assistance can they provide?
Well, we have a number of people. Some of them were retired diplomats or people within the UN community. A number of lawyers in New York from the area. We also had people who traveled in great distances to attend some of these meetings. We didn't have the expertise to deal with the high finance, the really heavy financial issues, or the legal issues, discussions of centering around the International Criminal Court, for instance. They're all being handled, have been handled down through the years by lawyers, by especially a group of lawyers who are involved with international law, some of the women's issues, and they still continue. I know that there are some university professors who are involved with these questions at the UN. We would have, and I'm going back a number of years, but we would have as many as 20 or 25 volunteers that would come to meetings during the various sessions, especially in the fall, because there would be many, many meetings going on, and the staff at the mission itself wouldn't have been able to cover what we needed to be present in. And so these people would give their time, a day, a week, maybe 2 weeks, at a shot, and attend these meetings, then follow the issue, write up a report, share with us the information that they were bringing back, but also to be able to speak that language at the table as those things were being discussed. They provided an invaluable service, not only to the mission, but to the Holy See.
It's really quite extraordinary. These are high-powered experts in many cases. Are they all Catholic, and were they able to make a difference on more than one occasion?
They were all Catholic, and I'm sure that, especially with the International Criminal Court and the legal issues discussions in the UN, some of these people were very well respected within the UN community. We had one lady who was a retired UN official who helped us with human rights things. She could walk into a room and you saw the respect that people had for her as from her background, that we were bringing somebody who wasn't just somebody filling the chair, but she was an important person in that meeting, and people respected that.
How long has the Holy See been an observer at the United Nations?
Formally, since 1964, and that role has increased over the years. At first, it was a very small representation, a Monsignor and a very small staff out of a very small office. Over the years, and that's increased. The role of the Holy See within the United Nations system has developed. And now, I honestly don't even know how big of a staff they have in New York and how many volunteers come in and all of this. But it has, over the years that I was there, it continued to develop and grow.
When you were there, how many people worked there?
There were seven of us full-time, professional staff, a few secretaries then. Archbishop Martino then developed a program bringing in interns. And so we had three young people, university students or recent graduates who would come in, especially for the General Assembly, and maybe these 20, 25 volunteers that would come in. So it was a rather large. Now, compared to a small country's delegation, it would probably be about average. I know some small countries, Andorra, for instance, there were three people on the staff. So we were more than that, but still much smaller than, you know, some other country that would be involved in many of the same issues that we were involved with.
I have an odd question for you. What would the world be like without an international body like the United Nations?
Well, it's not an odd question. And it's a question that's asked many times. And I think from the view of let's get rid of the United Nations kind of thing, or what good is it? But look at the wars that have been avoided, the conflicts that have been avoided, because we were able to discuss, because there was an organization that was able to send in peacekeepers, an organization that could arrange for aid, for food aid, for medical aid, for whatever it might be, tsunami relief. These kind of things you have to put on the plus side of why the United Nations continues to exist. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the recognition of human dignity, of universal rights, all of these things that we wouldn't have if there wasn't the United Nations, if there wasn't this organization that can bring people together, governments together, and talk and discuss the problems that not only are facing a region, but are facing the whole world community.
Monsignor James Reinhardt is an official with the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, a job he holds after working many years for the Holy See's permanent observer mission to the UN. The Holy See's permanent observer to the UN, Archbishop Celestino Migliore, says he expects UN officials to resume their work this September with a renewed sense of responsibility and the audacity to work for the common good in what some see as a flawed UN system.
National delegations are called to reflect and outline their plans for an effective response to the multiple crises we are experiencing, with particular regard to the revitalization of multilateralism and dialogue among cultures and civilizations. There undoubtedly exists the perception that without a clear reform of the procedures of decision, the UN will slide toward a dangerous loss of relevance. But the problem is not to find adequate technical and institutional solutions. Indeed, wise and effective proposals abound. The issue lies in the political will of the individual members that make up the organization, and especially of those who exert more political, economic, military, or demographic influence. They have to show the audacity to promote their own national interests in the context and function of promoting the common good of the world.
And thanks there to Archbishop Celestino Migliore, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations. September 16th marks the anniversary of the death in 2001 of Vietnamese Cardinal Francis Xavier Van Thuan. In his name, a special award is now given every year on this date to Catholic charities or individuals for their achievements in easing the hardships of others. In marking the anniversary of the Cardinal's passing a few years ago, Pope Benedict spoke to members of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace about their former president. Chris Altieri has that story.
Pope Benedict remembered Cardinal Van Thuan's many accomplishments, which included opening the work that became the compendium to the social doctrine of the Catholic Church.
Come dimenticare gli spiccati tratti.
The Holy Father especially recalled the Cardinal's simple and immediate cordiality, as well as his ability to speak and be neighborly with anyone and everyone. After a lengthy and painful battle with cancer, Cardinal Van Thuan died on September 16, 2001. His cause for beatification is underway. I'm Chris Altieri.
Well, Charles Collins now takes a look at this man who many call a gentle hero of the Church.
I was in prison in Central Vietnam. I was liberated after 13 years, 4 months, and 27 days.
That's the voice of Cardinal François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan, the president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. His story of imprisonment by the communist government in Vietnam inspired millions. In 1994, he spoke to Vatican Radio about his 13 years in a concentration camp.
When the communists came, I was arrested because the appointment of a new bishop 7 days before their arriving was considered as a conspiracy between the Vatican and the imperialism to strengthen the anti-communist struggle.
7 days before Saigon collapsed in 1976, then Archbishop Thuan had just been transferred to the city's archdiocese. When the communists took the city, he was thrown into prison. He spent the following years in different prison camps, 9 years of which were in solitary confinement, until his release in 1988. Archbishop Tuan said physical and spiritual exercises kept him going. Just walking in his prison cell, praying and writing helped him avoid being overcome with anguish and got him through his many bouts with malnutrition and disease.
I consider everything as the mysterious way of God for the salvation and for the sanctification. And it is very hard also, and sometimes I was sick. Sometimes I can pray. But I think I must change the weakness into strength. I remember somebody said, for the pessimist, every opportunity is a calamity. But for the optimist, every calamity is an opportunity. And as a Christian, a priest, I can be optimist because there is God with me. I am not alone, and I am optimist.
His optimism sustained him, as did his knowledge of the church in his homeland. With the improved political and social climate in Vietnam, there is an increased interest in the religion for which the cardinal suffered so much. The fruits of his sufferings, and the sufferings of so many others in the Vietnamese church, is that over 3,000 baptisms now take place every year. The cardinal always kept track of the situation of the church in Vietnam, and in this case, he recounted the story of a group of people who made a 6-day journey just to be baptized.
In the north, there is a tribe close to the border with Laos and China, and they are far away from the first priest, about 6 days walking in the mountains, and they came. 6 days coming, staying 2 days, and going back 6 days, 14 days, and bringing rice with them to eat. And they came to ask for conversion.
Cardinal Tuan said the witness of church leaders and members during Vietnam's toughest times are the seed which has sparked the recent growth in Christianity.
During the trials, tribulations, they see that the church is always truthful for them. We are faithful to the gospel, and we remain during the trials.
The example of Cardinal Tuan is an inspiration to all. While in prison, he fashioned a Bible out of scraps of paper. He fashioned a crucifix out of some wood and the barbed wire which confined him. He was released from prison in 1988 and came to Rome, in exile from his homeland. Pope John Paul II made him a cardinal on February 21, 2001. The church's new cardinal never forgot where he came from. Instead of the usual pectoral cross of silver or gold, Cardinal Francis Xavier Nguyen Van Thon still wore the cross he fashioned from barbed wire and a fence post, a sign of solidarity with the suffering church in Vietnam and throughout the world.
And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.